Hello, and welcome to the Queen's Observatory Fast Radio Bursts. I am Connor Stone, here with my co-host, Nikhil Arora. It is our mission to bring exciting space news hot off the telescope and into your ears. One way or another, the Queen's Observatory has continued its practice of sharing the wonders of the universe since 1857. Thank you for joining us in this long-running tradition. Here at Fast Radio Bursts, we will answer your questions, interview astronomers, and dive deep into breaking research. From low Earth orbit to the clouds of Venus, from Betelgeuse to colliding black holes, it's a big universe to talk about, so let's get started.
And welcome back to Queen's Observatory's Fast Radio Burst. I am your host, Nick Arora. I'm here with my co-host, Connor Stone. Connor, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am good as well. Well, this is our first time recording an episode in the year 2022. So, Connor, Happy New Year. How was the break for you?
Happy New Year, Nick. I got to see some family, though perhaps not as much family as normally I would have.
Yeah.
We all got extra vaccinated and tested and had fun.
Yeah, so I do hope that our listeners also had a peaceful Christmas break and they were safe and protected while celebrating and during the holidays. Okay, so let's move on to the meat of the episode here. But before we actually start with the meat, we have to go through some space news because there's something big happening. And that's James Webb Space Telescope. So on Christmas Day, at around 7 a.m., James Webb launched out of French Guiana.
I woke my family up in order to watch it.
Nice. Very nice. Yeah, I was up as well. I don't generally get up that early, but I was up to watch the launch. And it's been about 3 weeks since James Webb has been traveling to a million miles away from the Earth. And we are happy to report that everything has gone almost perfectly. So James Webb
Recording.
As of recording, yes. James Webb was almost folded in an origami fashion to fit into the Ariane 5, the rocket that was launched. And in its journey towards L2, it started to unfold and power up and go through some preliminary tests and calibrations. And everything, as of today, we're in mid-January right now, has gone perfectly. And James Webb seems to be alive and well. Now, if you guys are interested to know what James Webb is going to do, where it's going, and what's on it, we do have a series of podcasts on James Webb as well that we did last February, which we invite you guys to listen again as well.
Those episodes are titled A Telescope for the Past.
Yes, they are. So, yeah, why is James Webb a telescope for the past? Tune in to those episodes and you'll find out.
Exciting.
Exactly. Anyway, so now moving on to the current topic today, we are starting a new series today. We just finished the series of Dangerous Things in the Universe, and now we're going to flip the docket completely, and now we're going to start talking about the living universe, so maybe a more cheerful note.
I'm looking forward to this one. Got a little depressing in the end.
Yeah, when you start to destroy the universe, it can get a little depressing for sure. So yeah, the motive of the series is, I think there are three episodes planned here. The motive of the series is to really talk about how life generates in the universe and what can we as scientists do and are doing across the world to look for life, signatures of life on planets in our galaxy and even beyond. So today we are actually planning to motivate this search. And we're going to motivate the search for you through something of a paradox, which is going to be interesting. But also, might I add, it can be a little mind-bending. So brace yourselves in.
Everything in astronomy, there's big numbers involved, but it's really the concepts that we want to get to.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's the paradox that we will introduce today. It's called the Fermi paradox. And then in the next episode, we're going to talk about some of the solutions to this paradox, how do scientists understand this paradox, and then move on to some of the searches, some of the significant work being done in astronomy and astrophysics to look for life on other planets. So that's our plan. Let's dive right into it. Connor, well, I think it would be fair to say that we understand life as we know it. Is that okay to say?
It's actually a deeper question than it sounds. For the most part, you could say yes. We know life when we see it, like many things that are kind of hard to define. you know when you've seen it, but it's really hard to sort of in abstract come up with a concrete definition. Now, when astronomers go in search for life, they need to be a little more specific in order to get their science done and get concrete results. So quite often, astronomers will sort of take an incomplete definition and run with it, see if they can find what corresponds to that definition. So, for example, life is considered a characteristic of something that preserves, furthers, or reinforces its existence in a given environment. So it would exhibit all or most of the following traits: homeostasis, organization, metabolism, growth, adaptation, response to stimuli, and reproduction.
Okay, so you've thrown out a few big words over here. Let's try and break them down.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of things going on here.
Yeah.
And these are really just sort of fancy words to describe things that you probably already have an intuitive concept of.
Exactly.
Homeostasis is the idea of keeping yourself level even when the environment around you changes. So if it gets hot, you sweat. You sweat in order to cool down and keep your temperature at a very specific value. So your body is maintaining homeostasis by choosing the temperature it wants to exist at. In order for life to happen, it generally has to maintain a whole bunch of different parameters. So the acidity in your blood has to be kept at a very, very specific value. The amount of water and the temperature all need to be kept very constant. In order to accomplish these, there's a lot of organization that's involved. Metabolism is basically just processing food of some variety into energy that you can make use of. Growth, of course, things need to grow if they're going to be alive. Adaptation, of course, is required in order to respond to unusual events. And of course, response to stimuli is just saying that again.
Yeah.
Reproduction would also be a very important part of anything living, because that's essentially how natural selection happens and how you get more and more complex life, which quite likely we would have to be looking for certain degrees of complex life in order to detect it, in order for it to create a signal that we could actually measure. Now, these are all great ways to define what life is, but there's always gray areas and counterexamples at the edge of what we consider living. So a virus, which we are all very, very aware of right now.
We are nothing but topical in this podcast.
So a virus, it's sort of on the edge. People aren't really sure if it's alive because it's not so much maintaining homeostasis, responding to stimuli, or even doing its own reproduction. It's really just a chunk of genetic code that if it happens to end up in your body will do the reproduction for it, maintain homeostasis for it. It's basically just a molecule running around rampant in the world and messing with our bodies. Yeah. So hard.
Maybe one thing that's worth pointing out over here is that it's not just the human bodies that can reproduce viruses. It's anything living. So we know of many viruses that live in animals, for sure, and haven't yet, thankfully, crossed over.
Exactly. Well, many have, but that's sort of the thing, is they're basically just molecules that we do the reproduction for. Similarly, computers and computer viruses... computers actually maintain a homeostasis. They have a certain voltage coming in from the wall, and that voltage can even fluctuate a little bit, and they'll handle it. They don't really grow, but certainly computers adapt. Your computer today is much better than it used to be 10 years ago. Programs can be reproduced very easily. So there's some certain ways where you can think of computers as alive. Although, again, it's a gray area because they don't really fit all of the criteria, but they fit some of them.
Right. So, Connor, over here, when you say computers, you really mean any machine, right? Because you could have the argument that you just made for computers could be made for anything, any gadget almost, right?
Any gadget, sure. but because computers can run software, they can actually respond to stimuli. They can adapt in principle if we code them to do so. And in fact, we even run genetic algorithms that
computers
behave very similar to life and simulate this sort of behavior.
This
another one which
is going to turn very Terminator-y.
So it's sort of a gray area because they don't fit all the criteria, but they really do a good job of fitting some of them. And even surfactants, soap, soap actually, it's full of lipids. One end is polar, one end is nonpolar. They actually create these little bubbles that are almost identical to a cell in a living being. These bubbles will, of course, maintain whatever gets trapped inside that bubble is going to stay there. So it's maintaining a homeostasis. As more and more surfactant molecules add to this bubble, it'll get big enough, unstable, and then it'll break into two bubbles. That's reproduction, right? So in a sense, soap can fit some of the criteria for life. And the cells that we use are actually lipids, like the same thing. It's just organized better in living beings. So there's lots of edge cases. And I thought it was important before we talk about life to talk about the fact that it's really hard to get a concrete definition that categorizes anything you look at cleanly into living or not living. So that in that vein, astronomers then have to be really specific when they're talking about life. They may say, I'm talking specifically about carbon-based life forms that are aerobic or anaerobic or something even more specific than the whole category of all life, because maybe they are going to specifically look for a chemical that's produced in these sorts of, in the metabolism of anaerobic bacteria.
Fair enough. Okay, so with that thought and reasoning out there, based on what scientists look for when it comes to looking for life, do we expect life to be there? And if so, why?
Right. So there's a few reasons to expect life to be out in the universe. First one is we already know life exists in the universe. You can just point to yourself. That's a living thing in the universe. So we have tons of life here on Earth. We know that it's possible because we've seen at least one case. We've proven the existence of the set. And even quite complicated life, right? Enough that we make really noticeable impacts on our whole planet. We also, what I think is really interesting and important is that life emerged on Earth really quickly. At most, a few hundred million years is when Earth first became habitable. So it wasn't just a molten lava ball. From when it stopped being a molten lava ball to when life first existed, it's just a few hundred million years. That is a blink of an eye from the universe's perspective. Super, super fast. So that's one reason to really expect life to be out there, because when the conditions are right, it can clearly happen right away. The second one is just the scale of the universe. Anyone who's watched the movie Contact will know the quote, the universe is a pretty big place. If it's just us, it seems like an awful waste of space.
Great movie. I highly recommend watching Contact for sure.
It's a great movie, and it's a great point, too.
Yeah.
The universe is huge. The numbers are just insane. There's 100 billion stars, give or take, in our galaxy alone. There's hundreds of billions of galaxies out there. So there's just so many stars. Even if a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of them have life, we're talking about billions of life forms out there. And this is actually encoded in what's called the Drake equation. And Drake was basically just the first guy to notice or to write it down. And he basically just said, let's take the total number of stars and a whole bunch of factors that represent the probability of various things happening, multiply them all together, and see what we get out at the end. So we could start by asking, like, how many, we've got 100 billion stars in our galaxy. How many of them have planets? And then how many of those planets are in the habitable zone, the zone where life could occur. We don't really know what that is yet, but let's say it's just wherever liquid water occurs.
Yeah.
And to be very conservative, let's say it's 1 in 1,000 stars. So only 1 in every 1,000 stars is going to have a potentially habitable planet.
Right.
We can say of those planets, which ones have a rocky surface with liquid water that would sort of be an area where life could grow and evolve. Let's say one in 1,000 again. Then we need the fraction which develops life. That's changing all the time. But since it happened so fast on Earth, let's say if the conditions are right, it's just 100%. We know that life is going to happen in some way or another. Then we can say, what about intelligent life? We don't really know. We can just pick 1 in 100. Like that's a small number. There could be 100 planets out there with life and only one of them would get to intelligence. Sure. What about a bunch of factors that we don't even know yet, factors that could have stopped a living thing from occurring? Maybe there's lots of asteroids that come around and destroy civilizations.
Or attack from other civilizations, like we talked about.
Or attack from other civilizations. So let's just tack on an extra factor of 100 there.
Yeah.
That would still mean that there's 5 intelligent civilizations right now out there in our galaxy. And over the lifetime of our galaxy, it would be hundreds. Because this all occurs relatively quickly on the timescale of a whole galaxy, which is like 10 billion years. So 5 intelligent civilizations and hundreds over the course of our galaxy's evolution means that it should be teeming with life. The galaxy should be full of living things, intelligent living things specifically. It should be even more, like a factor of 10,000 more planets that have some form of life on them.
Yeah.
So it should be everywhere. But the paradox is
we don't see it.
Yeah.
So if the paradox is that we don't see life everywhere, how do you solve this paradox in the most practical sense?
The most practical answer is just we haven't been looking long enough. It's been less than 100 years since we've had any sort of attempt at looking for life out in the universe. It's also light travels really fast on the time scale of things happening here on Earth. But for our galaxy, light travels really, really slowly. There's probably only a few thousand stars which would have received a signal from Earth. And it would be so faint because it was some of our first signals that we would have been sending out way back when radio was first being developed, radio technologies were first being developed. So really, we're just babies on the time scale of looking for life in the universe. The little bubble of what we've been able to see is only like 1,000 galaxies, or what we've been able to communicate to is only like 1,000 stars. Sorry.
I think one of the first ever radio signals that were sent out was Hitler's inauguration of the Berlin Olympics.
Yeah, that was one of the first ones that would have been powerful enough to like make it into space.
Yeah.
But even that would be faint by the time it gets to
another star. Yeah.
So we haven't really sent out a signal that could be detected by any other life form in the galaxy. And perhaps we can't expect others to have done the same. It just hasn't been enough time. Perhaps that's the solution.
Yeah.
We'll get to a bunch more, much more creative and interesting solutions in the next episode. But for today, we're going to really focus more on this paradox.
Okay, I guess this is a good time to take a break. And we will be right back diving deeper into this paradox.
Hello there. I'm just stopping by to quickly let you know that the Queen's Observatory is always here to answer your space questions. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and our website. Links to all of these are in the podcast description. We're always happy to talk about the universe, and if you ask a really big question, we just might have to do a podcast about it. I would also like to mention some of the other great resources out there. In the podcast description, you will find links to the McDonald Institute, the Royal Astronomical Society, and the Astronomy on Tap program. They are all excellent programs to bring the universe down to Earth. And with that, let's get back to it.
And welcome back. We are talking about the Fermi paradox, or the paradox that we just sort of calculated as to how many different planets should inhabit contain. intelligent forms of life, yet we don't see it. I guess we're going to move deeper into this paradox, but let's start by asking this question, Connor. What does it exactly take for a planet to have life? Are there different factors that scientists consider, for example? I mean, right. One of them is quite obvious, but...
I mean, some of them are pretty obvious, but it's worth stating them. And I think that's sort of the point, is we've been talking about life in abstract. We just sort of said like, oh, what if it's 1 in 1,000 chance that a planet is habitable or in the Goldilocks zone? But yeah. We need to talk a little bit about what that actually means. What is it that a planet needs to have in order to be a habitable planet? And the first one, I think perhaps the most universally known, is that there needs to be liquid water. Liquid water might seem like a really specific thing, like, well, couldn't it just be any liquid? But water actually has a lot of nice properties, and it's a great place for chemistry to happen. I guess we could go more general and just say you need some liquid, but you definitely need a liquid. Chemistry happens really well in a liquid, and chemistry is where the complexity comes in life. Now, why do we think it needs to be water? Well, in a lot of industry,
right?
Liquid water, yeah.
Yeah.
In a lot of industries, water is actually referred to as the universal solvent.
Yeah.
Water is really special because it's polar, but it's quite small as far as molecules go. And so it's actually able to dissolve a lot of different chemicals and keep them in solution. So water has this nice property of being able to hold a big variety of chemicals in it. So if your life is able to create the correct chemicals, water is definitely a good place to put them.
Right.
Now the Goldilocks zone, the zone where liquid water occurs on a planet, is actually kind of a fuzzy zone. You can calculate, if we took Earth and moved it around in our solar system or another solar system, you can calculate basically pretty hard windows for where liquid water would occur, modulo some weather effects, which can also make it a little fuzzy. But liquid water can occur well outside of what we would call the Goldilocks zone under special conditions. One such special condition happens right here in our solar system. It's the moon Europa, which orbits around Jupiter way outside of what we would consider our Goldilocks zone in our solar system. But it's got a icy surface and a gigantic liquid water ocean underneath, more water than we have here on Earth.
Yeah.
So that's a huge reservoir of liquid water. It doesn't get sunlight. It's kept liquid by other processes, which are complicated in their own. But it's this giant ball of liquid water.
Yeah.
Maybe there's life in there. I really want NASA to send a probe out there and drill through the ice and see what's under there.
Haven't we talked about this in a podcast? I think we talked about Dragonfly, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But Dragonfly is going to go to Titan, which is a different thing, but still.
Right. Titan does have liquids. It does have weather even.
Yeah.
That's another moon in our solar system, but it's not water. It's methane.
It's liquid. Yeah, methane.
Yeah. So water is really exciting, and water turns out to be like everywhere in the universe. So that's actually a pretty solid element of the whole life equation that we know is pretty abundant and very encouraging that it's all over the place. Obviously, wherever life is going to be, there needs to be a possibility for some complex chemistry. So there needs to be lots of different elements that make up a planet. Earth, our atmosphere is oxygen, nitrogen, argon. Our ground is lots of silicon and so many other elements all over. Phosphorus, sulfur. Anyway, there's lots of elements all over. And this is actually why the first generation of stars in our universe definitely did not have any life. Because in the first generation of stars in the universe, they would have been made up entirely of hydrogen and helium. It actually is the first generation of stars and generations afterwards, which created a lot of the elements that we need for life.
Right.
So, when I said earlier that the Drake equation predicts that there should be hundreds of civilizations over the course of the lifetime of our galaxy, we can already answer one bit of that puzzle. Actually, life couldn't occur at any point in our galaxy's evolution. It has to be later on, like what we have now, because only now are there enough elements out there to create solar systems with the kind of chemicals that would be needed for life.
Yeah, for sure. Right. I want to put forward two shameless plugs before, Connor, you continue. one of them is JWST. We just talked about the first generations of stars, and JWST is going to look at these first generations of stars and try to understand how the universe was early on once stars were being formed. And second, I think I've mentioned this a couple more times, but how heavier elements get created in the universe is also a good question. To that, Connor, you have done a talk on that, which lives on our YouTube page. So go check that out as well.
Yep. There's definitely lots of really cool science behind how different chemicals are created in our universe. Right. So that's definitely a fun one to look up.
Exactly. All right. Moving on.
Yeah.
What else?
So for the complex chemistry to occur, for information to travel from generation to generation, you need something like DNA. It doesn't actually need to be DNA, but it does need to be like DNA, as in a very, very complex chemical which can store information. Now, here on Earth, even here on Earth, there are variations on DNA. So there's something called the RNA world hypothesis, the idea that DNA wasn't even the first kind of storage information for life. It was actually RNA, which is it's not double-stranded, it's single-stranded. It's less stable, but it's easier to make. So it makes sense that maybe that would be the first one, but it's not as good as DNA. So DNA would have won later on. We can also, in the lab, generate different ways of encoding DNA. So DNA is like a computer program. And in labs, we can actually mess with that and change the code so that it creates new or different amino acids as you or uses different amino acids. It's complicated. Anyway, and then there's even bacteria out in the wild which use modified DNA to survive in different extreme environments. So there's lots of DNA is not a core needed thing for life, but it needs to be like DNA. It needs to store information. And we do know that chemistry works the same everywhere in the universe. Like the same chemical reaction on a different planet should work out the same way. So there may be some convergence in what these sorts of things end up looking like, but wherever there can be variations, random chance suggests that there probably will be lots of little variations there. One of the other things that life needs is stability. So life arrived on Earth very quickly, a few hundred million years at most, but it took about 3 billion years to get from the first life forms to intelligent life forms like us. So life is kind of slow and it needs a stable environment. It doesn't need to be perfect. I mean, Earth has been bombarded by asteroids. It's had giant volcano eruptions. Right. It's been covered in ice during giant ice ages that cover the entire planet. Like, it's had some rough times, but it was stable enough that life could carry on through all of those various hardships. Yeah. And build up to the intelligent life that we have today. So if we want intelligent life, we need a planet that's going to be stable for a very long time. That means we probably don't need to bother looking at very large stars, because the largest of stars only exist for tens or hundreds of millions of years. So life on a planet around one of those stars would just get started when then the star explodes and vaporizes the planet. Yeah. So that's our dangerous universe creeping in again.
Yeah.
So, and as we talked about in the dangerous universe, there are lots of really catastrophic things that can happen.
Yeah.
So you need some sort of stable environment like our sun, which lasts for about 10 billion years. So we've got plenty of time left to continue to become an even more intelligent civilization. Another thing that life absolutely needs is a source of energy. So in our case, that's the sun. The sun provides energy to the surface of the Earth and allows all of the processes of life to happen. A lot of processes in life involve essentially reducing entropy, and you need energy input in order to make that happen.
Yeah.
So In order for life to occur, there must be some source of energy. It doesn't need to be a star, though.
Yeah.
Here on Earth, in the at the bottoms of the oceans, there are hydrothermal vents that can create
life.
A lot of heat. And yeah. Heat can be used as energy. They can also create. They can also inject new chemicals, which is a form of adding energy to the system if you're constantly yeah. adding in new chemicals. So hydrothermal vents could be a way for life to exist on a planet which is perhaps too far away from its yeah. star, but it still has Europa. Liquid water.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Europa is an example where, fingers crossed, there's hydrothermal vents in there and there's life clinging to these hydrothermal yeah. vents, which would be super exciting. I really want to see that.
I mean, it's here on Earth, right? There are places down in the depths of the oceans where you have just plumes coming out, and the chemicals and the heat created allow for microorganisms to just live there and feed off of those. So yeah, it's totally possible.
It's totally possible. Some scientists even think that the first life forms would have yeah. formed around hydrothermal vents
yeah.
Because they're a really excellent location for life to occur.
Yeah.
They've got all the right chemicals, and they would even before life had started moving chemicals around on the surface of the Earth.
Yeah.
In general, a lot of these energy and some of these other requirements come down to saying that what life needs is a gradient. It needs somewhere where it's light and another place where it's dark. It needs somewhere where there's heat and another place where there's cold. Life exists best at the boundaries between
the yin and yang of the nature.
The yin and yang, yeah. Life exists best at boundaries between really intense locations.
Yeah.
So coastlines are actually a great place for life because there's water and land. You get a lot of complex life right along coastlines. In a hydrothermal vent, you have the vent and the ocean.
Yeah.
A cold ocean beside
yeah.
it.
Cold, dark ocean. Yeah.
So there's an idea that some of the first life forms may have just been lucky, complicated molecules that would float up in the vent and then float over to the ocean and then back into the vent and sort of in a circle. And at first they would have been lucky, but as they got more and more evolved, they would have been able to make it happen. And then it's sky's the limit for life.
Yeah.
So what life really needs is a gradient, somewhere where there's a difference, a chemical difference, a heat difference, a light difference, water versus land difference. It needs these things in order to survive or to thrive, really.
Yeah. Okay. So we have covered quite a few factors that are required for life, Connor. But a question worth asking is, how common are these things? And more particularly, how common is the occurrence of all of these things together? Because presumably you need a great fraction of these factors to come together to make life.
Exactly. And that's basically where the study of astrobiology and yeah. the looking for life in the universe, that's really where it all comes down to, is how common are these things? One that we've kind of got a more concrete answer on now, thanks to telescopes like the Kepler telescope, it looks like for stars like our sun, about 1 in 5, which is really high, a lot of stars,
yeah.
20% of them have an Earth-like planet in their habitable zone. So that's two criteria, rocky and liquid water. And it's a 1 in 5 chance. That's huge.
Yeah.
Although really, that just makes the paradox even worse. That
yes.
means that our numbers were wrong before. We were too pessimistic. There should be even more life out there in the universe.
Yeah.
We can also say water is extremely ubiquitous in the universe. It's all over the place. In our solar system, like Earth has it, several moons have it. Mars at one point had rivers and lakes, and
yeah.
it would have looked very similar to Earth. So there's water everywhere in the universe. Complex chemistry is also common now. Now that stars have had several generations to produce more chemicals, we can even, without any life involved, we can just look out in space and find amino acids. These are the building blocks of life. These are the chemicals that living things here on Earth are built from. So we find these just hanging out everywhere.
Yeah.
So there's all sorts of complex chemistry going on in space, even before you get to life and you get down on a rocky surface where it's even easier for this kind of chemistry to happen. Stability is just sort of a numbers game. Like, there are lots of stable stars out there. In fact, they're more common than the unstable giant stars.
Yeah.
So there's lots of those out there. So really, a lot of the factors in the Drake equation that we started off pessimistic for are actually very common. So life should be everywhere.
Right.
And that's really the problem, isn't it?
It is. So which that actually does mean that there's some sort of universal mechanism or a so-called great filter that is sort of removing intelligent life or even life, such that there aren't many life supporting systems in the universe.
Exactly. And that's what we're going to spend the whole next episode talking about. Yeah. Is how do we solve this paradox? Why is there not like 100 intelligent civilizations? Yeah. And aliens landing on our backyard, right?
Yeah.
Like, why aren't they everywhere?
He is my friend right now.
Exactly.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Because certainly by the numbers,
yeah,
the more we learn about life, the more we think it should be just everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So this brings us to the conclusion of this episode. We'll be back next time and we'll try to solve this Fermi paradox and see why we don't, and try to come up with reasons as to why scientists think that there is no life.
But tune in. It's going to be fun.
Exactly. Well, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Queen's Observatory's Fast Radio Burst. We hope you enjoyed this walk through the universe. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to contact us via email at queensuobservatory@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter as the Queen's University Observatory to stay up to date. If you like this podcast, you can help us by leaving a review and sharing it with your friends. This will help us become more visible and spread the wonders of the universe to more people. That is all from us. We'll be back again with another exciting topic in astronomy.